here. Small group today. As I say, we've got competition with the treasure hunt
today. Yeah, we're all...
Lama's that way, you know, if there's no parties, then people might venture over, otherwise they get lost on the way. All right. So please just relax. One thing we find it very hard to do is relax. You know, we all know how to kind of lounge around on the sofa or whatever else, but actually mental relaxation, that's not so easy for us. We're always holding on to something. So just to be able to let whatever phenomena arise and pass away, arise and pass away. Just a very kind of carefree, detached way. Then you find the more you can let go, then the more open and spacious one's awareness becomes. And just because you're not resting on anything that's coming in through the senses. Because the tendency is, as soon as our consciousness rests on something, then we begin to build and construct. And then we get lost in our own mental construction. So I'd just like to start today, as usual. Please check your motivation for being here. And those of you who are regulars, then I don't really say anything new about motivation. I think one's understanding deepens as one begins to see just how confused we are, just how distorted our perception is. And this is why we're here. We're here to work with the confusion and to clear the distortion, or just, in a way, create conditions so that the distortion will clear by itself. The more we work with our own confusions, and the more we can benefit others. It sounds simple, but to really understand what we're doing here and how valuable it is, you know, that takes time. That only comes when we really begin to see how we're trapped in our own mental conditioning. So let's just begin with a simple exercise, just to allow a bit of mindfulness into how the consciousnesses, the six consciousnesses, work. So I just want you to do the exercise of just note which sense door your consciousness is moving to. So simply, when you notice you are listening to something, then you either say hearing or sound. If you notice you are thinking about something, then just mentally note thinking or thought. Seeing or form. Feeling. Smelling. Where you just totally relax and just observe where the consciousness is moving to, and as fast as it moves, I want you to note which sense door the consciousness is moving to. Now, this is not so easy if you haven't done any practice before. So, when a thought comes up, don't go into the thought, just immediately say, thought. Another thought arises, thought. Feeling, smell, thought, thought. Taste, feeling, wherever it goes, as fast as it moves, just make a mental note. What is happening? Which sense door? The consciousness is that. Is that clear? All right, let's do that. Is that clear? Yeah. Let's do 5 minutes. So what do you notice? When you say get lost in a thought for a bit, is it a sequence of thoughts or is it one thought?
It tends to be a little bit of a story.
Yeah, it's a story, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's not just thought, is it? It's already gone.
It seems to me that, you know, when there's external stimuli, then it seems that it's more fragmented because there's something happening, whereas if you get caught in a sort of internal thoughts, if you like, however you want to label it, then it seems to have more continuity and there's more of a chance of a daydream. But I don't know if that's actually true. I don't know if the one is more fragmented than the other.
Okay, let's see if we have anybody else. What else did you observe? Anything?
I think that's my way of
using the jumping line. I found the jumping got slower as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
Label
the sound than it is label thought. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
It's a very
easy
to label
thought.
If you hear a sound, you can label
it.
So
it
can be several seconds before you
hear it. Melanie,
what did you notice?
Decidedly calming and habituating to some of the external sounds fairly quickly, so that when I did get into a pre-associative thought process, I wasn't aware of sounds anymore. The whole process did slow, so it was very calming.
Travis, what did you learn?
I found myself oriented strongly towards listening. Hearing sounds in the beginning, and I wasn't noticing many thoughts. But then when I did start to notice thoughts, I was catching on to labeling. And it may be just my imagination, but it seemed like a few times when I did label a thought, that it sort of stopped. There was a gap, like afterwards, like a feeling of immediate, short feeling of space after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very helpful, this practice, because this is all that is happening, you know. There's no secret agenda going on here. We're experiencing our world and everything in our world just through these six sense doors. It's as simple as that and precise as that, you know. There's a moment of seeing, a moment of thinking, a moment of feeling, a moment of thinking. And then it happens so fast. We are missing so much because we don't have that level of refined perception to actually see the moments of change, the moments of consciousness that make up our experience. We just put it all together and then we think, yes, we're sitting in a room and pack up. That's it, isn't it? It's one single event. That's how we see things. So, by doing this, we refine our perception more and more. We can see more clearly, and we become more detached, because we can see how the thought process, what we call the six consciousness, is there, always interpreting. It's always got a story. And our habit is to get lost in the story. We're just sucked in constantly. The consciousness is sucked into that.
And the more you do, the bigger the gaps get.
The more you practice this, then you, what happens is you can let go more easily, and then you find stillness in movement. Because you can just flow. There's no lingering on anything. You can flow.
I find I can have stillness if there's no thought, but when I'm busy and involved in lots of things, then I lose that. When I'm, you know, working, for example, then it's hard for you to get that stillness again.
That's, you know, it comes with just a minute here or a minute there during your daily work activities. You just stop and then flash the baby-like attitude. Just that glimpse. And then another glimpse, another glimpse. And then slowly you find this habitual pattern of getting sucked into the sixth consciousness. Then slowly it weakens. More and more space. Everything becomes more transparent. So first of all, we have to see the transient nature of the phenomena. We have to see that everything is changing moment by moment. Not just on an intellectual level, you know, by looking and seeing. There's a moment of this, moment of that, moment of this, over and over again. Then it comes into the emotional way that we deal with things. But unless we're familiar with change, then it just remains on the intellectual level, and you'll still very much cling on to things when something happens that you don't like or something happens that you do like. There's a tendency both to get involved in what you're thinking at that time and building it up, constructing it in some way, and then we get lost. We don't see clearly. I really find this practice, this is what we mean by vipassana, insight. You have your shamatha, which is just being able to calmly rest, whether you use an object of support or whether you use no object. It's just being able to rest calmly. And then insight is actually seeing the true aspect of the phenomena. What is actually happening? It's not what you think is happening. So we have to bring these two together, vipassana and shamatha. And this is through any practice you do, whether you're doing dzogchen or mahamudra or visualization practices or just simple breathing in and out. It's this preciseness that we need to develop. Preciseness allows you to see things clearly. Okay, now we started a couple of weeks ago, Travis, and I started talking about what we're doing here is a kind of rough survey of our own psychology, the psychology of this idea of ego. And in Buddhism, it's made up of eight aspects of consciousness. So we talk about six sense consciousnesses, the normal five senses that we know. And then the conceptual mind is considered to be a sixth sense, because it's always there interpreting everything. Then we have seventh consciousness, which we call really the ground of ignorance. Everything is perceived, but in a very unprecise way, a very cloudy way, a very kind of dualistic way. And then we have an eighth consciousness, which is what we call the storehouse consciousness. And that holds all the seeds of all our impressions. So then something happens through the senses, which is interpreted as dualistic. There's something out there which is separate from me happening. So there's a tendency to objectify. And then the seeds come up from the eighth consciousness, and they act like filters. And immediately, I don't like that, I like that, that's good, that's bad, that's right, that's wrong. It acts constantly, changing filters. We have 51 of these mental factors that arise, that change the way constantly that we see things. And all this comes from the eighth consciousness, all stored in the eighth consciousness. So, to actually see precisely what is happening, then it cuts through this habitual pattern. And we have more and more space to see clearly, and then this pattern weakens. Okay, let's go on. I'm not exactly sure where we finished up, but... So we said the eight types of consciousness can be looked at as being on the level of the first of the five skandhas. We have five aggregates that we're looking at here, and these aggregates make up our own ego psychology. So first of all, we have form, and form is not our usual concept of form. Form here means anything other than self. Anything other than self. Yes, because we consider it to be my body. It's other than self, isn't it?
Other than self.
Anything that you relate to as an object. Actually, yes, it's still. Yeah. Anything. You have a whole idea of your body, don't you? How your body is. My body. My body's like this. My body's sick. My body's this. My body's that. So it's very much an object that you're dealing with other than self. Still something to be perceived by a perceiver. So anything that is perceived by a perceiver is considered to be form. Anything other than self. And this is the basis. We have to have that feeling that something is happening other than perceiver and perception, and then we build on that. So why does this happen? Why does this feeling arise? And we talked about this. It was, in a sense, we cannot adapt to the speed of change. We cannot rest in the speed of changing conditions. Remember, I gave you an example of driving a car or roller skating. If you're driving a car and you're going along, but you're going quite fast, and then all of a sudden you realize that you're going so fast, and you put the brakes down, then it's very likely that you'll have an accident because you just don't know how to work with the speed. But if you know how to work with the speed, then everything just flows. So this is what happens. We don't know how to work or how to flow with the changing conditions. There's the tendency to want to grasp onto something. The grasping gives us a sense of security for this idea of self. So we're always grasping onto something, holding onto something. Remember the definition of mind? You tell me. I repeat this every time. Anyone remember the definition of mind? Maybe I... Sorry to put you in this position. I just said it so many times that one of anyone remembers it.
Yeah.
Rodney remembers.
That which creates something other than yourself. That which has dualistic thought.
Exactly, almost, but not quite.
You've
missed the trick.
What's the trick?
The trick is that which creates the object. Yeah,
yes.
In order for the subject
right,
to exist.
For the subject, yeah.
Right.
Mm.
to that which is anything other than self, that perceives anything other than self, is what we consider to be mind. Mind is not a thing, it's a process, it's the way it's synonymous for ego in Buddhism. It's the way the idea of self functions. This is mind itself. So it only works in duality. It's just one definition. I'm sure you're going to hear many other definitions, but this is the definition that we're using here. So it makes the object stand for the subject. Now, usually we would think that we'd have a subject first, and then we would have an object from the idea of a subject. But here it's the opposite way. Here we have to have an objective world in order for there to be a perceiver of the objective world. So the more solid the phenomenal world appears to us, then the more secure we are in the idea of ego or the idea of self. Because you have something to relate to all the time, something to bounce off. This is a this. Well, if that's a that, there must be something here to perceive it. This is a very clever trick. This is why whenever we feel insecure, we always make something solid. The object that we're dealing with, we always make it more solid. It appears to us as something unchanging in that moment. And then we build on that. All your emotions come from insecurity. So as soon as you're feeling a little bit of aversion or anger, then immediately you must have a solid idea in your head. This is like this. This person is like this. This situation is like that.
Isn't the mind is very similar to a form in that sense, other than yourself?
No, the mind is the process. It's not the form itself, but it's the basis for the ego. Form is the basis for the ego, but then you have to have feeling, which is like an antenna of form. Try and understand this on this level, because we can't really go on unless we understand form, how form works. So ask questions.
Are you saying that the I arises from some sort of misunderstanding of our perceptions?
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. It's an error. It's a total error. That's all. That's what ignorance is. It's a total error. And then...
related to some fear. Insecurity.
It's a kind of panic of not being able to work with changing phenomena, impermanence. And so then we have to freeze changing conditions. So then, as soon as we freeze whatever is happening, then we feel secure. Then there's something here, perceiving something there. So constantly we're freezing the changing phenomena, and we're freezing it into objects. So there is no objective world. There's just what we call moments of consciousness. Constantly changing. And then we freeze it into something. And this something is like this, and then we build on it. And this is good, and I like this, and I don't like that. And the more solid we make it, with these different aggregates that we're going to talk about, then the more secure we maintain this idea of self constantly. So the only way that we can work with this is to first of all see that the phenomenal world is transient, changing conditions. And then slowly the phenomenal world becomes more transparent. And at the same time, this idea of self will also become more and more transparent. And then this feeling of something perceiving something there begins to melt. And then the more it melts, then it becomes open, spacious awareness. And then we go beyond this dualistic function of mind. Then we go into what we call awareness itself, the ground of our own being. I usually give the analogy of, you know, you put two ice cubes in a bowl of water, and they both seem very solid and very real, and they're both entities. There's one ice cube there and one ice cube, and they seem so different from the water. But then under certain conditions, they both melt, and there you are, go back to the nature. So this is the same, similar, what happens. The idea of self and the idea of the phenomenal world as being an entity, they both melt in this rest, in this open spaciousness. Understand? Mm-hmm. Any questions?
So it's not that you stop perceiving things the way that you react or relate to the perception that changes.
Yes, you're not trying to block anything.
Yes,
you perceive everything, but in a very precise, very clear way, because you're not lost in your own interpretation all the time. So the enlightened mind is not something that doesn't see, doesn't hear, doesn't smell. That would be more like a zombie, wouldn't it? You'd have to lead the enlightened mind around all the time. You become more precise. You see. You're right, you're present in whatever is happening, moment by moment. You're totally present.
So, yeah, some of us, we have a lot of pain in your body. How does that work?
Sometimes there was awareness and sometimes there wasn't awareness.
Sometimes you could see, okay, that's interesting sensation happening, but you would leave on to this pain.
Yeah, sometimes very detached, and you don't perceive it as pain. When you're that detached, it's just
it's
not even that. It's just very, it's not nothing, nothing in itself. But in other times, then the tendency there also to solidify. So I'm far from perfect. I'm still working with pain. It's not a good teacher for me.
That must be the hardest. It seems like it must be the hardest thing, the last hurdle to get over is physical, because, you know, sound, light, smell, those are kind of remote. But when it's your own body creating a strong sensation, that seems like that must be the hardest thing to detach from.
It's interesting. People, many people ask me that question. I say, usually it's only when I'm teaching that I don't experience pain. Yeah. It's interesting how the mind works. When you're not focused on it, then it's not there. But when I try to get up or try to move, then of course it's hard for me to move around.
But you're focused on something else, acutely.
Yes, that's what I mean. If you're listening to something, then you won't smell anything. Wherever the consciousness goes in that moment, then it excludes everything else. It can only be at one sense door. We really think that we can see and smell and hear at the same time. It's impossible. The more you refine your perception, you actually can see how it jumps around from moment to moment. It's changing. Everything, you can see how everything is made up more and more. Nothing is solid. Yeah, it's a good practice. You can't run away from it. Yeah. You can run away from a lot of things, but you can't run away from pain.
And it's easy one to create stories around.
Yes. How nice it would be if I didn't have to go through this. So what happens if it gets worse? You can build it with lots of stories. Okay, so the eight types of consciousness, we could say, are the first of the five skandhas form, and they are the form of the ego, the what we call the tangible aspect of it. And they also are like the grounding element of ego, but we know that ego doesn't go very far, so there's not much grounding element there, but still, if we look at it, it's a grounding element. So from a relative point of view, they seem to be fixed, something definite, our senses. I think we went over this last time. And I said it's like energy that flashes out of the basic ground. And as you said, Tavis, it's like a blinding effect. What happens is it's a bit like coming out of an anesthetic. And when you come out of an anesthetic, then you... Anybody here? You've been through an anesthetic. Anybody else been through an anesthetic here? You've never been through something like that. Yeah? You've been through, yeah. Okay. When you come round, it's like you want to know where you are, who you are, where you've been. It's a kind of bewildering effect. You need to ground yourself. And so this is very much like our ignorance. You know, we're constantly trying to ground ourselves in something. This brings a blinding effect. And this blinding effect then becomes the eight, what we call the eight consciousness, the basic ground for ego. So it's an error that comes out of being confused. So then rather than just being completely one with our projections, the projections then take you over. And then the power of the projections comes back to you. But you don't realize that this is your own doing. The projections are your own doing. They seem to take on their own identity, these projections. So as I said many times before, it's as if we divorce the projection from the projector. So you've got this movie going on, but somehow there's no projector there. And this is life. We have this constant, what seems like continuous experience going on. But we don't realize that there is a mind, this process of mind, which is interpreting everything. You know, we've got lots of sound effects here. We'll wait till... I should always say, turn off your mobile phones before you go to a teacher. Yes. Modern day living.
Always connected.
Always connected.
These new ones take a long to shut off, too. Hi. Hi. The glasses. Hi.
Ah, your glasses. You want something to lie on there? You,
yes.
All right, it's cold. What about the carpet here? You can it's too cold to lie there. So we could say that this idea of ego is what we call the ultimate relative. It's the source of all relative concepts in the samsaric world. Think about this for a moment. The ultimate relative. So you cannot have criteria, you cannot have notions of comparison. Everything comes from the idea of self, the ego. This begins from ego's impression of reality. So you can't have nirvana without samsara. You can't have liberation without samsara. So all your ideas, all your criteria comes from the idea of self. Freedom and imprisonment. All relative situations, they have this quality, basic quality of ignorance. If we don't see clearly that they are relative. For most of us, the way we see relative is we see it as something ultimate. We see it, this is this, but we don't see it in relationship to anything else. So when we think about imprisonment, we don't think about freedom. Am I right? Yeah. When you think about right, do you think about wrong at the same time? No, you don't.
No, but the opposite seems to hold true. You're in prison, you want that freedom. And if you're wrong, you're more attached to your need to be right. Mm.
But you don't. It doesn't come up at the same time, does it?
Yeah, I think it does, because how would you know one without the other? You need the reference.
Yeah, isn't it somewhere in the background, always, and hanging around? Otherwise, why would you be so strong if you didn't have another reference?
Right. Sometimes I feel different parts of me. That part, more right, that's more wrong.
But just think about this for a few moments. You know, your experience, is it really relative, or do you see it as something absolute at that moment?
You can't handle two thoughts at once.
You can't handle two thoughts at once.
You may see it as absolute or experience it as absolute, but it's still in relation to the opposite.
Yeah, okay, but as you experience it, let's look at our experience. When we experience something, do we experience it as an absolute or a relative?
I think we tend to reify it, meaning that we tend to make it solid, and therefore we're making it an absolute.
Yeah, making it an absolute. That's from my experience, but I'm just wondering from your experience if you see it that way or not. Because if you think something is real, then it would have to be an absolute. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And we're often wrong.
Yes, we're often.
And you can often prove to yourself that you're wrong. You see the form of something on the table, you look at it and you think, oh, it's a caterpillar, but it turns out to be the stamen of some plant. For example, you know, what's happening with your body? Or whatever it might be, you know, the classic story is the coiled rope and the snake, isn't it? It's exactly the same thing. And the sound, you know, we're tempted to think that objectively that is Mrs. Chan's shop. But it could be, well, it's something emanating from Mrs. Chan's shop, but we've made it solid. And we can look at it more closely, and it could be different aspects of Mrs. Chan's shop or whatever. In fact, it's unreal as the melodrama. drama narrative that we've got caught up in the next moment as the sixth sense. We think we can agree on what that sound is.
Yeah.
We think that we can list the beginning and the end of that sound as well and make it discrete and talk about it. But in fact, it's not like that. It's part of a continuum.
Many times, you know, I ask myself and others, you know, do we see it as real? Do we see this experience as real or not? If you didn't see something as real, would you react to it? No, there would be no reason to react to it if you thought it was an illusion. It's because we think it's real in that moment that we react to it. That we think it's something bad or something good.
What are the different levels at which you can think something's real or not? I mean, I personally find it quite credible that, you know, my feelings about somebody can be temporary and, you know, it's based on my perception rather than anything intrinsic about that person. But when it comes to things like something physically very solid or an illness, you know, a serious illness, this kind of thing, it really does seem to depend on something outside myself. You know, when it comes to my own feelings, if I can sort of accept that they're completely irrational or, you know, I mean, not based on, I don't know, perhaps that's...
But an illness is within your body.
No, it's not. It's a real illness.
Yeah.
Only your leg can drop off, you know. That can't be in your mind.
Yeah.
If it's not there, you know, and I can't walk, I have to hop everywhere. I mean, that can't be just a mental hopping.
Yeah, that seems much realer than dogs jumping in and out.
This is like Graham. Graham usually comes up, well, if you get knocked down by a car, you know, is it real or not real?
Also, your example of coming out of anesthetic, you're disoriented to time and space and place. And it's very healthy to reorient. And if you didn't, you'd be entering a psychotic state. It would be deeply disturbing and deeply threatening. And you'd probably be drawn to immediately. And this is what happens often with schizophrenia, that they are no longer oriented to time and space.
Yeah, but I'm talking in general, you know.
But I mean, what I'm getting at is that there is a natural and normal impulse to, when you're disoriented, to reorient to time, place, space. And the way to do that is to relate to the objects around you.
That's our present way of reorienting.
Yes.
That's how, this is what I'm exactly what I'm talking about. You know, this is the pattern of ego psychology. It's to make the objects around you solid, so then you can secure your ground.
So how else could you reorient coming out of a drug state, say, without falling into dualistic patterns?
Well, it depends whether you have any practice behind you or not.
But I think this is exactly where I get stuck, is while I understand somewhat at least your words, when I go to hold up, this is purely dualistic, interesting. Do I have an alternative way of thinking about it, an alternative image of what you're talking about? Actually, I don't.
No,
you talk about spaciousness, but I can't operationally relate to it. You know, a moment in meditation if I'm lucky, but outside of that, I'm in a really good mood or something. Maybe I'm feeling more open and what you would label spacious, or not attached to this, that, or the other. But fundamentally, I don't think I have any true understanding, certainly no visual understanding of what you're talking about.
Okay. when we're introduced to the view, this concept that we have of the view, it actually gives us the confidence, because we see directly this spaciousness. Until that time, it's just an idea.
Okay, so it's what happens in meditation,
yeah.
If you like.
You know, some people have said it's the gap between two thoughts. You know, the last thought is gone, the next thought hasn't arisen yet. What is there? That's, His Holiness Divacenzi always used to say that over and over again. I think it's very, very helpful. The last thought has gone. The next thought hasn't arisen yet. What is there? But we don't, you know, we don't give ourselves that level of relaxation to appreciate that. Because our habit is always to get lost in what we're thinking.
You know, I mean, even if you have that moment of seeing, as soon as you've labeled it,
yes, that's right. It's,
you're back to doing
it. Lost. Yes, that's it. But that's our habit at the moment. So, you know, the analogy is the clouds part, we see the sun, but then the clouds come back in again. And over and over again, this is what will happen. There'll just be a glimpse, and then the clouds will come back in again. And then again, there's another glimpse. But then each time there's a glimpse, there's more and more confidence. So then the projections become more and more transparent.
On retreat, we were given a little card.
Hmm.
Perhaps you've seen it. If you look at the card and then close your eyes, the image, it's reflected back. And this was used as an exercise to acquaint ourselves with seeing basically emptiness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just the image. But once again, you know, I was trying to work with it, and I only have an intellectual process that I can bring to it. But it felt a little contrived after a while. I mean, as kids, you look out and then you close your eyes and then you see the image. So sure, we're taking some teachings to look at the image differently and integrate it in a different way. But it, on one level, it did feel contrived.
All right. Let me again go over the definition of meditation. Meditation is familiarization. That's all it is. Familiarization with another way of seeing. So the repetition is so important, because now what is unnatural has become natural. Can you imagine how many repetitions are involved in order for something unnatural to become natural? So now again we have to repeat. This is why they say to us, try and do a bit of practice every day. Include it in your daily life. A minute here, a minute there, 5 minutes here. Whatever you're doing, include it so that it becomes familiar. The familiarity makes it natural. And then you can let go of those old habits of perception. They become weaker, and then finally they just have no power anymore. So it's really important that. So I don't know what Rinpoche was doing, but you know, maybe he was just introducing you to another way of seeing. That's all it is, introducing you to another way of seeing. Okay, we look at the six senses. We've only done that for 5 minutes. But we do that for days, for weeks. We'll go and sit by ourselves, and then my teacher would say, right, I want you to say out loud everything that comes into your head. And you do that for weeks. That's all you do. And it's absolute garbage. Yeah? Until you become detached from the thought process. then it really weakens our patterns. Yeah? But you have to do it. There's no way but doing it, but practicing. You can't intellectualize about these things. Really important, the practice element. There is no way that we can go beyond mental fabrication by using mental fabrication. Yeah. Here I'm introducing you to the components. Yeah. This is a kind of very scientific analysis of, you know, our ego psychology. But it's just showing you different components, how they all come together. Because now we see things as solid. We don't understand the components that are necessary for us to have a simple experience. So this, if we understand slowly, okay, this, and then this, and this, and this, and this, and then, oh, wow, that's how it works. So then we're not sucked into the process so easily. You want to say something?
No.
Any questions?
I think one thing that people get hung up on is the word illusion.
The what?
The word illusion.
Illusion.
When you say that everything is an illusion,
yep.
And our teachers often say that.
Mm.
Can you explain a little more? I know that's exactly what you've been talking about this whole time, but maybe you could define a little bit what you mean by illusion. Because it sounds like we're all sort of walking around in a dream and, you know.
Yeah, it does sound like that.
It's some sort of fluffy cloud, you know, that we're sort of hovering on and not really perceiving things. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think Dr. Kenzi Rinpoche gives a wonderful example. And I think I expressed this last week. You. It's night time, and you see me, and I have a torch, and I have some cloth at the end, and I dip it into the oil, and then I go out at night, and very slowly with my hand, I start to make a circle. And then I speed up, and all you see is a circle of fire. Now somebody who walks in at that moment, they're totally seduced because they haven't seen all the conditions that make up that circle of fire. They just see it as a circle of fire. And that's an illusion. You don't see the conditions that make up our experience of reality.
So when you look at a tree, you can't see all of the conditions behind the creation of that tree.
Yes.
So the tree is an illusion?
So the tree, the way you see it, is an illusion, yes.
Simply because you aren't able to see what made up the creation of that tree?
Because you're not seeing the tree.
You're seeing a picture in your mind.
You're seeing a picture in your mind of the tree. And you believe the tree exists out there.
But you can touch the tree, it exists.
Not. Not the way you think it does. Relatively speaking.
The car doesn't really exist. My car doesn't
exist. Remember, relatively speaking, the tree exists.
Right.
Appears to exist. I will not say exist.
Okay.
Relatively speaking, it appears to
exist
in a relative way. Depending on conditions, there is a tree.
Right.
Ultimately, there is no tree.
Right. There are just conditions that create an appearance.
That's it. There's conditions that create the appearance. If you go back to the six senses, which sense is the tree? You can only experience it in six ways. Now, which way is the tree exist?
Sight. Sight or touch? Maybe smell.
You will ask you, this is your experience. Don't go much. Your tree. How do you see the tree?
You can experience it every way except perhaps one of them as it falls down.
The wind is
blowing. You can experience it by touch, by sight, by mental image.
You're not the tree.
If you close your eye and you touch it, do you still want the tree? If you didn't see it before, no.
So where is the tree? This is what I mean by seeing precisely. You know, actually see what is happening moment by moment. It's not exactly what you think is happening. So you're not. It's not a question of not seeing, it's a question of really seeing. We've never actually, we've never experienced things through our senses on that level where we are seeing, we are hearing, we are tasting.
And if you were, what would that be like? If you were seeing the tree in that way, what would it be like?
You consider that.
Yeah.
It's not a question of me telling you the experience of it. It's, you see it precisely as it is, not how you think it is. There's a big difference between as it is and how you think it is.
Yeah, but Annie, if I'm shown a picture, if I see a tree that I've never seen before, am I seeing it more closely to how it is, even though I have the concept of tree? Or if I see a really strange tree that doesn't fit my concept for the first time?
Then you may not even know it's a tree.
Right.
If it doesn't look like a tree to you, because you've been conditioned in a certain way, this shape, this kind of leaves or whatever, that's a tree, but
so
that is a bush. That's a bush.
Yeah.
So then there'd be a difference between a bush and a tree, wouldn't it? As soon as it changes its shape, or the trunk becomes a bit thicker, then your bush becomes a tree.
Yeah, so?
So then, where I'm asking you, where is the tree as it stands, as an entity? Where is the tree? What is the tree? How can the tree exist?
But an enlightened person would still walk around the tree.
Yes.
They wouldn't walk through it.
No, it wouldn't. Well, maybe, but I don't.
They could if they wanted to.
No, that's not the point. Relatively, the tree appears to exist. Relatively.
Okay, the tree
but
doesn't
we
have
don't see it.
Outside.
We don't see it like that. We see it as a tree out there.
Because we've learned the concept of tree. But even without the concept of tree, there's this thing in the ground that's growing up. And if we saw it the way it is, without the label.
Yes, without the label.
How lovely is
it? It may not be lovely to someone else.
No, it may not be lovely.
But still, if you ran into it, you would hit your head.
Yeah, but that's not. This is not the question. Yeah, it's how does it appear to exist?
Okay.
That's not the question.
You might have a middle plate in your head.
I think of its own accord by itself. We forget that it takes so many things. Sunlight, seeds, even the seeds need certain things to grow. Mm-hmm. There's so many different things that come together to make it happen.
We always get stuck here with the idea of solid matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is our problem. But when you look under a powerful microscope, there is no solid matter. It's because of our gross perception that we see things as solid.
It's true, it's just space. It's just space. And science has shown that if you look closely at anything, all you find is space.
Moments of consciousness. But our habitual tendency is to see it as something solid. And then we build on that.
So maybe if someone was enlightened, that's and they felt that space, and they knew that true space, they could walk through that space.
It's possible. You have people like Milarepa, or these great saints, they could do all these things, fly in the sky, walk faster than any, endless miraculous paths. But that's not the point, to develop these miraculous powers. They're like side effects of this awakened mind. Levitation, all this stuff. Yeah. Now we're so confined to our perception of reality. It limits us constantly because we really believe it's like that and we don't want to go further. The way we maintain this ego psychology is by making it solid. So we can't see its transient, transparent nature, because correspondingly we'd also see that the idea of self is transient and transparent. We don't want to see that. I don't think we really want to wake up, to be honest. I don't think we do, because the tendencies are so strong.
Well, as you say, it gives us a sense of security.
Yes.
Of being grounded.
Yes. We need
of
to.
Of being present where you are.
Yeah. Ground ourselves constantly.
Well, it's hard to imagine how anybody could function in the world if they learned this at a very young age. I mean, it's good to learn this when you're older and you've seen a lot and you've already done a lot. You know, and you can learn from your experience and you can, you know what I mean? You can kind of learn that you have to let go and all that. But it's hard to imagine that, like, if you're just a young person and you were taught all this, I mean, how would you function in the world? Because the world is constantly telling you, you have to create a solid sense of self. You have to do this. You have to do that. You have to see the world this way. Otherwise, you can't be a part of our society.
Isn't that very kind of, I mean, it's a very Western way of looking at how people function, but this idea of, you know, you gain your individuality, and being a blob, you become an individual, and then you keep maintaining it.
Yeah. I mean, you're encouraged to develop a very, very strong sense of individuality, sense of self, sense of me, this is me, I'm special, I'm different, I'm this, I'm that. You can't function if you don't have those things, you know? So it's kind of interesting to try to tear that all down, you know?
I think you won't fit in that society, but I don't think you can still function, but you just won't be accepted in that society.
Yeah.
You'll be doing something different.
But maybe if you had, if a child was growing up and you were teaching them this through metamorphosis or something, just naturally, they would have such a grounded sense of, well, not themselves, but something, being a part of everything, that's all that, I need to be this, I need to be that. It's still with a lack of self-esteem as well. So maybe if you brought a child up really living the Dharma, then it would be able to survive.
You should see these young children who are being trained by my teacher, Dungsi Tumi Lolo Rinpoche, they are amazing.
Yeah.
They are really amazing.
They have this view at that young age?
Some of them have this view,
Well, I just went to a brief article in one of my journals I have with me about a group of high school students that were taught empathy and compassion. The goal being to graduate them not only with high academic standards, but also as finer human beings. And their test scores improved as a result also. But that was secondary. They improved 15%. But to foster empathy and compassion is to foster connection, you know, beyond yourself and your own narcissism.
It's interesting, actually, because I mean, Hong Kong's got a very big Christian influence, I think, and I've got lots of students who have been to Christian schools. Quite a few who are pretty keen Christians. And actually those students tend to be, I find, I don't know if you find the same, more mature and more inclined to have thought about these questions of right and wrong and so on. I mean, even if, you know, you're not from that background, it's just the experience. And I mean, I guess, you know, when you talk about fitting into a society, I mean, you make society, don't you? Like, all those different people that create a kind of society. I mean, I think it's hard to talk about society as one monolithic block because there's plenty of people like that around, all sorts of different cultural or religious backgrounds.
Okay, let's go on a bit more. I appreciate all your questions, because then we can see how much we understand of this, you know, our resistance to certain ideas. And it's just our habits that really produce a lot of resistance. Yeah. It's very, very hard to introduce a different way of seeing without practice. You have to see yourself. You have to come back to your own experience. You know, the awakened mind is not born out of theory. It's born out of seeing. You know, seeing how, what is happening moment by moment. Seeing precisely. So once there's this bewilderment, then this kind of double take happens. So we want to find out where you are, what you are, where you're at. But at the same time, this basic confusion doesn't want you to go back. It doesn't want to find out about the original situation. You don't want to undo everything and go back. Because the confusion itself has created something that you can hold on to. So you want to ignore the history of what led you to your present experience. You want to make the best of the present moment and you want to hold on to it. So it's a kind of ignoring and refusing to go back. Maybe because it's too painful or too frightening. You just don't want to go back to see how everything arises, how we create our present experience. So then understanding ignorance. There are many ways of understanding ignorance. If we go back to the early teachings of the Buddha, then ignorance was kind of a one-way process. This kind of basic confusion, and then we hold on to the sixth sense consciousness, the objects of the six senses, and then we develop from there, and ignorance takes over. But if we look at more at the Vajrayana approach to ignorance, then we will see that in each moment there's also wisdom. So if we can just rest the mind, then at that moment there is wisdom. You know, it's not something in the distant future. It's just we let go of this constant dualistic fixation. Just relax, let things come and go, and then it just opens up. And that is the ground of wisdom, that is basic awareness itself, that's the view. So within ignorance there is wisdom. You understand? If you hold on to anything that arises through the six senses, then that is ignorance. You're holding on to something which is securing this idea of self. But when you just can relax and just let everything arise and pass away, then everything becomes transparent and open. Let's do some practice. All right. Okay, the question. When we're looking at the thought process, where does the thought come from? How long does it stay? Where does it go to? Right, so just try to focus on a thought. Okay, rest. Yes.
Well, I don't seem to come from any particular place. And it's goal that doesn't know anything.
Is there anything there?
Apart from the body?
It's a thought in itself. Does it have any substance, any colour, shape?
It's not beautiful.
Not exactly what we were supposed to be doing.
I know. I was noticing.
Alright. What did you notice, Eric?
Similar to Roberta. That's the thing talking about the future, which seems to have seems to be a source of inherent energy. These are not totally new thoughts, but they're changing the whole time, and it's impossible to hold on to anyone, even though you really maybe want to. Then it kind of gets elusive, it changes, it slips, and you move onto something related and new. I was fairly unaware. I don't know if we were supposed to be doing it in the past time. We're not doing it in the past time. It's more seems from the sit sense.
No, actually, the exercise was to really see, you know, just try to isolate a thought, not a concept, not an idea, just a thought, and keep coming back to a thought.
Yeah,
you know,
not possible. It seems to switch. It seems to change. You can't actually hold it.
But when perhaps when you're not well, I was trying to watch my breath, and then you got some thoughts that come, and I tried to do that, but it did. I was trying not to have thoughts, but I knew I would. And they seem to be, they're moving, so they seem to come into awareness and out, and so they're moving. And they seem to be very, very, very quickly followed by a little feeling in my chest, which is slight. Or something. So that there was a kind of colour. You said what colour? Did you say what colour are they? Yeah, so they were. It was sort of a, there was a sort of faint feeling like, don't really want that thought, or, things like that. After they stopped.
I what happened.
They don't come from anywhere. They don't go anywhere. But there are thoughts about thoughts. I know what Marianne is talking about, that when you have a thought, then it's, I guess, quite common for me anyway, to have a thought about the thought. Like, well, why do I have that thought? Or why are you thinking that? Or I don't want to think that. Or, well, that's a nice thought. And then you can build. So I think that thoughts are, I don't know, that there is a connection from one thought to another, or a continuum from one thought to another. But that, so they don't, the first thought doesn't come from anywhere, but there is a thought that comes after that, that arises into the conditions of the first thought.
Yeah, you're not looking at the thought itself. The whole point is to isolate
one thought.
And then if you lose that, you isolate another thought, and you keep doing that.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Well, this is what we have to keep doing. You have to familiarize yourself until you see the transparency and the transient nature. If you don't do it and see it yourself, it's not going to work. You. It's not going to change the way you see. You have to keep doing this, and you have to do it precisely. Don't get lost in adding one thought to another or defining the thought, or this is a good thought, that's a bad thought. You've lost it. That's not what we're doing here. We're just looking at thought. Where does it come from? How long is it there? Where does it go to? That's all.
But that's analysis. Then your thinking comes in. Where does it come from? Where is it going? Then the thought process comes in.
But the more you do it, you will see directly.
When you say
see. You won't be analyzing, because it will just be another thought. But you have to do it. It's like we have to go through the process in order to see.
Well, when you say isolated thought, what does that mean?
Where does the thought come from? Any thought, as it arises, where does it come from? How long does it take? Where does it go to? Then it's gone, right? Another thought.
Is there an opposite of where does it come from?
You have to find it yourself. There is no answer that I'm going to give you. You have to see yourself.
No model answer.
No model answer. No. Sorry, no multiple choice. I know you're dreaming about multiple choices. You know, if there was an answer, I would give it to you. But this is about your own experience, and this is what we're much happier when we have a theory about something than actually looking and seeing directly. When we have a theory about something, it seems to maintain our ego. It makes us feel more secure. When we see directly, even though it's much freer, the whole experience is much more open, much more freer, much more precise, we run back to the theory again, because we're habituated to run back to the theory, to have an idea about something. And then we can express our idea and we feel good. We've got an idea. Isn't it funny? Yeah. It's just a habit, that's all. But we can't loosen these habits until we see. You know, what is a thought? Does a thought have any substance? It's no good intellectually looking. You have to look again, again, again. How long does it last for? As it comes, it's gone. Yeah? It's not a question of lasting. Yeah. As it comes, you know, this is why I always use the analogy. The moving river, okay? From right to left. You have your eyes focused on one point in front of you. You don't look upstream, you don't look downstream. You just keep focused. And then whatever is on the surface of the river, it will come, and as it comes, it goes. As it comes, it goes. As it comes, it goes. You need to familiarize yourself. This is how the mind works. Nothing stays unless you try to freeze it. And when you freeze it, you know, that's not looking at the true aspect of the phenomena. That is not the way it is. That is the way you want it to be in order to feel secure. But that is not the way it is. It is just gone. Until you see there's nothing there. It really has no substance whatsoever.
But the wisdom is inherent in that ignorance.
The wisdom is inherent in that ignorance. Just seeing. There's the difference between ignorance and wisdom. In Sanskrit, it's so clear. Vidya and avidya. That's all it is. Vidya, to see. Avidya, negation. Not seeing. Not seeing the true aspect, seeing the true aspect.
So this doesn't involve thinking about the thought, trying to understand what aspect of the ego it came out of.
No. In the beginning, it's a little bit intellectual because, you know, there's a question there. Where does it come from? So we try to look. Where did it come from? Where did it go to? But the more you look and the more you see, it doesn't really come from anywhere. It doesn't go. It's not enough for me to tell you. You have to see that. How long does it last? But it doesn't last. So what is it? Why am I controlled by this? Why am I following these insubstantial? Why am I reacting like this? Why am I getting angry? Why am I this? What? You know, because you see what it is. But now you don't see, so then totally controlled by the projections. Projections are only thoughts. Your preconceptions make your perception. Everything that you think makes your perception. Because it's just this constant, you know, mechanism of projecting outwards, and it's like imputing, overlay on what's coming in through the five senses. Mm-hmm. So immediately, the concept, it's just a concept. Out there is a concept. In here is a concept. I often say, you're in a field and you put four walls up with a roof, and all of a sudden you have an inside and an outside. And this is the same. With the body, we think there's inside and there's outside. In here, that's me, and out there, that's the world, and everybody in the world. It's just a concept. There is no in here and out there, only on an interdependent level. But we don't see that because we're habituated to this constant pattern of relating between a subject and an object, a perceiver and an object of perception, constantly backwards, forwards. I like, I don't like, I want, I won't want, this. And now everything is frozen. The idea of self is frozen into an entity, and everything that we relate to is also frozen into entities. So we are not seeing. We're seeing frozen space. And that frozen space is our objective world. And the frozen space is this idea of self also. I've got these two ice cubes. You get the feeling? So, we do need to practice, and a lot of us have a lot of resistance to practice because we've been introduced to practice in a way where we've had to put in a lot of effort. And actually, it's not about effort as such. It's about, you know, it is discipline. It's a discipline in the sense of you need to repeat over and over again. You know, until you become familiar with the process, or just familiar with seeing it in a different way. And then it becomes more natural, and you find your perception also changes. Your habits of reaction become weaker. There's more possibility, there's more space to see things in another way. Now, the habit, immediately something happens and it presses a trigger button all the time. We're pressing these old familiar trigger buttons. I say something, a little bit of criticism, immediately you react to the criticism. That's not right. Who does she think she is? I say something nice. Oh, yes, that's me. Isn't it? I mean, we're so weak because of the way we react constantly. We just cannot take criticism because it makes us feel insecure. Whereas praise, yes, of course, that's me. I'm like that. I'm lovely. Why? Why? They're just words. Yeah? Both of them are just thoughts. But why do we react when we hear one thought in one way and we hear another thought in another way? One attachment, desire, or more of that, aversion, anger, get away, I don't want to deal with that. Why? Thoughts. Where's the content? That's because we don't see. We don't see thought as thought. All the teachings by all the masters. I'm not a great master. I've never put myself up as a great teacher. This is, you know, from my own practice, from the teachings that I've received, that I pass to you. And they all say the same thing. They say the same thing in different ways. And listening to one teacher, it will make sense to you, even though they're saying the same thing. Listening to one person, their expression, you'll be able to connect with their expression, and something will open for you personally. The whole thing is, it must make sense to you, these teachings. Otherwise, it's not going to change anything. So I give you a lot of intellectual groundwork to play with, because that's how we are in the Western world. We want to think about things. You know, we want to make sense of it. But also I ask you to practice, because without the practice, we're just not going to get a taste of, you know, what's behind all these words. Any questions?
I think the woman last night was talking about choosing your thoughts and saying, you know, you could just be much happier by choosing happy thoughts. Do you think there's something in there?
Choosing your thoughts. What I say is, once you really begin to see that your experience is illusory, it's not real, then you can play with it. You don't have to leave it one way. You could change it, because it's an illusion that you're creating. Yeah? But until you see it's an illusion, then everything is real. Then it remains something that you can't change. If something is real, you can't change it. Yeah? But if something is an illusion, then of course. Yeah? If you created it, you can uncreate it. You can deconstruct it. You can play with it. So then I say to my students, I say, how about, you know, one day you make the person into the worst person you possibly can, you know, the absolutely disgusting person. And then the next day you make them into the best person you've ever come across, you know, just by changing the way you think about them. You know, you have more positive becauses, you know, more positive reference points than negative reference points. You know, so that person is bad because they smell, because they talk too loud, because they don't do this or don't do that, and so on and so on and so on. Well, if it's an illusion, then the next day you can play with it. Okay, that person is really so nice. Yeah. Because. Yeah. You don't have to leave that person with that negative appearance. That's, in a way, choosing your attitude, choosing other. But you need a little bit of space to do that, a little bit of space to play with. And this is why Tonglen is so helpful, because that's exactly what we do with the Tonglen practice. You know, you're breathing in everything that you consider to be negative, and on the out-breath you only breathe out what you consider to be positive. So as soon as any negative thought arises, immediately you breathe it in and breathe out positive. That's all. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Literally. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in. And then you see how you can change things. but we're so attached to the opposite, you know, only taking the good, and anything that's bad, trying to push it out, get away from me. That's our habit. So this is a reversal of our habits, a reversal of ego's main strategy of maintaining itself, you know, always wanting what's good for me and always pushing away what's bad.
So the idea of choosing happy thoughts in order to be happy is actually the problem, because it's, you're giving those thoughts the power to make you happy. So what Tonglin does is it takes the opposite approach,
yes,
and you breathe in the negative thoughts, and then you realize that they're just thoughts.
Yes, but there's more to it than just realizing that there's thoughts. Yeah. I mean, you need to really go
breaking
through.
Breaking down that habit.
It needs to be done in a very,
precise way.
Because you're working on what you think is negative about your own psychology first. What would you like to change about your own habits? Impatience, aggression, jealousy, whatever it is, yeah, offhandedness, whatever it is. And you look at all these things and you breathe them in first. You need to own all of it, because this is your own habits and your own tendencies. And then you breathe out the opposite. What can release these tendencies? What can transform these tendencies? And the opposite you breathe out, patience.
I think that's something quite interesting with this particular type of Buddhism anyhow, is what I've learned from you and other people. This idea of using negative things, not just positive things.
Yeah.
As the manure.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
This is Mahayana. This is Mahayana Buddhism. Mm-hmm. You use your relationship with other beings as the path mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not shutting out anybody or anything. Mm-hmm. You're using it as the path. And this is why, you know, the motivation, working for the benefit of others, you know, how to do that? What's the best way of doing it? Well, of course, working with your confusion. Mm-hmm. And then you don't share your confusion with others. That's the most profound way to mm-hmm. benefit others. You know, of course, you can give them a nice something or other. Yeah. But that's not going to help them in the long run. Mm-hmm. Long run. So then once you look at your own habits, then slowly then you think about those beings who have shown some care for you in your life. This is important, to find, you know, at least one person who has really cared about you in your life. And then the wish that they could be free from suffering and confusion. You start with one person. And then you breathe in all their suffering and their confusion so that they can be free from it. And then breathe out every moment of pleasure and every moment of happiness. Any good feelings that you have, you breathe out. So you don't possess the suffering, don't possess any of the negativity, just breathe it in and immediately breathe out something positive. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. And this is the way that we familiarize ourselves with different, in a way we're creating another habit. But this habit will support our path, whereas our negative habits do not support our path. They work against us, but we don't see how they work against us. They just make us more and more self-centered. Whereas the positive habits help us to kind of melt down this self-centeredness, more open, expansive, begin to see the equality of each being. That's why the Mahayana approach is so helpful. You know, everybody wants to jump into Dzogchen. Well, you can't practice Dzogchen until you have a good grounding. This grounding really opens your heart. Chimpa used to say that, you know, unless you really have a good grounding in Mahayana, you have a clear intention, then it's like you know, practicing a deity without a heart. There's no heart to the practice. You see these teachers, and they're so warm and open, generous. You know, it's natural. They're not trying to be a certain way. They're just like that. But they've all done a lot of training. They've all done a lot of training. Just a little bit more and then you can have your tea. I haven't got very far. So, the wisdom of dealing with situations as they are, and that is what wisdom is. That's all it is. Dealing with situations as they are, not how we think they are.
So it's not all your concepts about
them. Hmm?
Your judgments.
Yes, all your judgments, all your comparisons. It's not seeing things precisely. So it contains tremendous precision. And this precision comes from physical situations. Comes from sight. Comes from smell, feelings, tangible objects, sounds, and this is the what we call the earthy situation. This is the basis of this precision, and this is the source of wisdom. So it's possible to become completely one with smell. Yeah, possible. Or sight, feeling. And then your knowledge about what you're experiencing, it ceases. It's just seeing, feeling, smelling, tasting.
I think that happens a lot to us. I mean, we just don't develop it. If you're suffused with pain suddenly, you're completely immersed in it. If you have someone who's wearing a nice scent, it's just the life. You're in with the scent, because that's my experience. There's not a concept about it. It's just pure pleasure. A beautiful sunset, maybe a gorgeous fireworks display.
So then there's nothing to know about things as an external educational process. Nothing to know about things. That's wisdom. It doesn't come from seeing it as an object. Wisdom doesn't come from seeing the world as objective. It only comes from basically coming back to the very simple things like your senses, how it works, that's the grounding element of wisdom, present in the situation, moment by moment. I don't know your experience. You tell me if it's like that or not. So then you become completely one. The sound, smell, sight, and so on. This is very much how Vajrayana teaching works. This is why we use simple experiences like breathing to develop meditation, because it's so simple, so precise. Just breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. You don't need to get lost in your thoughts about things. So then when you're not lost in your thoughts, then you can see clearly. To understand the difference between seeing and knowledge about seeing. One you've learnt, yes. You've learnt about the object, well that's a very nice cup and it comes from China and the dragons are like this, or not so good or whatever. You're not really seeing it, are you? You're seeing your version of it. So the only way to develop a real sound meditative technique is to take something ordinary and use it. And unless you take something simple, then the whole state of mind in your meditation will be based on conflict of what is real and what is not, and your relationship to that. And then it brings all kinds of complications. And then one begins to interpret these complications. And then they become psychological problems or neurotic problems. And then we develop more and more a kind of paranoid frame of mind. Then we don't see clearly. We just think there's a lot more going on than what is actually happening. And this is what we do all the time. Yeah. Constantly thinking there's a lot more going on than what is actually happening. Yeah. And that causes our emotions to come up. So here we're relating to non-duality on a practical level. And if we use simple things like sensation or sound or breathing, then we can step out of all our paranoia. And it really helps us to just, you know, see more precisely. And then it's just it's more about getting into actual things, you know, sights and sounds. You know, whether you're washing the dishes in the kitchen, you're really there. You're involved in the action. You're doing it. You're not thinking about something else that you should be doing. mean, that was the wonderful thing about my Zen training. You know, it's a headache for everybody else, but I think it's a wonderful thing about my background is that, you know, we were put in this situation where we had to wash thousands of dishes, and you'd really find you become more and more present with the action. Otherwise, when's this going to finish or whatever? My teacher used to shout at me in the morning, you know, we were out there in freezing cold weather, and we'd have to pull out every weed from every crack, you know. My mind would be saying, but I like that weed. that looks beautiful there. Just do it. Do it and be present in what you do. Be mindful of what you're doing. And the whole of the Zen meditation was like that. You know, be present. Be present. And I often tell you the story when I went to see the master. He would come every 2 weeks and he would invite anybody who wanted to talk about their experience. And I thought, do I have anything to talk about? And then all my, you know, background from the Tibetan tradition, all this experience and that experience, this clear light vision and that. So I thought, maybe I'll go talk to him. And I went up there and he was a tiny little man. And had this gigantic big table. Oh, this table made of a tree trunk. I don't know where he got it from. And then he said, so I started talking about my experience, and all he said was, have a cup of tea. It's as simple as that. Have a cup of tea. Be present. Here I was talking about something that had happened in the past. That wasn't what was happening.
Wasn't it? I'm sorry, I don't quite follow.
You know, when we talk about our experience, it's always the past. It's something we've been through. So we're just pulling it out from memory again, saying, oh, I've been through this and I've been through that. Yeah. Whereas, you know, he was saying, have a cup of tea, which was, you know, just be in the moment, just be present in this moment.
Doesn't the daydream have the same, like you described before in this course, confusion, but status? Doesn't the daydream have the same status as the awareness of having a cup of tea?
The daydream?
Mm.
No, I think that the daydream, you're lost in your thoughts.
Yeah.
If you're aware, okay, that's not something to say daydream, but it's the thought, memory, yeah. Does memory have the same status?
No, not at all, no. Awareness is very much, you're there, moment by moment.
It's just the thought though, isn't it? I mean, the thought about the past is just the thought in the same way the thought about the tea is just the thought. What's the difference?
No, it's not a question of a thought about the tea, it's just have a cup of tea. Mm. You don't have to think about it.
Have thoughts about the tea.
No, I don't disagree with you.
You may be thinking about having a cup of tea.
Even when you're drinking it.
That depends where you're at, Eric. Not everybody's the same as you when they have a cup of tea. If you're an enlightened master, then just have a cup of tea. It's not thinking about the tea. Just being mindful moment by moment, like we're doing. We're doing now. We're just introducing ourselves to what is actually happening moment by moment. You're just there. You're not thinking about having a cup of tea. Then, maybe later, if I say to you, you know, well, did you enjoy the tea? Then you'd have to think about it. Did I enjoy the tea? Yes.
Well, if you're an aficionado of tea or coffee, then
yes.
You really appreciate a good cup in the moment. Not to mention wine, of course. But still, you're in.
You tell me what you're thinking, Eric. I see the disagreement.
I still think it's not in the moment, really. But you can use it as a guide, as a rough guide, as a discipline. You can use it as a discipline, but it's conceptualized, and it's not really in the moment any more than say the memory sense is in the moment.
So you're saying someone like Rinpoche couldn't have a cup of tea in the moment.
But that would be true in the moment, too, when you really, when something is truly
yeah,
true.
Yeah, but I suppose it would be my
you
view.
You don't like the moment.
Nice
you
or nasty tea.
I
think the problem is the moment, being
yes.
in the moment.
Yes.
Longchenpa has a quote, something like, don't follow after the past and
don't get lost in the future.
Don't get lost in the future. And don't get lost in the present either.
Don't get lost in the present.
Yeah, don't get lost in the present either. So the present, I know what Eric is saying, the present can also be a story.
Yes, it can also be a story. Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
No, but that's the dualistic, isn't it? That you can be having the story and having your experience, or let the story override your experience. But I submit to you on multiple levels, it's not only cognitive. The example of tasting something bitter, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but the amount of taste buds that are sensitive on the tongue to anything poisonous is hundreds of thousands, if not millions. So you will instantly have a full reaction to anything that could be dangerous to you.
Yeah, you said this last time, and I said, well, why do people take poison then? Why
well, they're not worried about the taste at that point now, are they?
Yeah, but if that is the case, it doesn't follow on.
No, it really doesn't. If you taste something that is harmful to you, you'll notice it instantly. And if you don't, you're at risk of dying early because you're likely to imbue something or imbibe something that is very harmful. Someone who is intentionally taking poison, their minds are somewhere else. They don't care about the taste, or they might cover up the bad taste.
Yeah, but if you're given poison and it doesn't taste like poison, you put some orange juice
yeah.
with it, then you're not going to know that it's poison.
Yes, that's true.
So
it's
where does your logic fit
it's
in?
It's just an obvious. I'm talking about being present. If you taste something that's off, you will notice it very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's very well camouflaged. There's a reason for that on a survival level. And it takes you right into the present. Oh, I don't like this. Oh. And that's not, I don't believe, it's the cognitive makeup in a nanosecond afterwards. But it is a survival mechanism. And that's why it takes precedence.
Isn't it like, I think someone mentioned recently about sneezing, for example, that's a moment of I've also heard many, many years ago a school teacher explaining that your heart stops momentarily as you sneeze. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's like an extreme condition, and it's a moment of awareness. I think something drops on you, or you're about to be poisoned. And maybe in those moments, that's almost transformative. I don't know if that's what you're trying to say. When you're heavily threatened, then it's almost transformative.
Well, you're so instantly in the present at that point, because there are many more, on a neurological basis, we're much more attuned to any threat, any danger to our survival than we are to pleasure.
So, well, that's the case. We have so many opportunities then to remain in the present. Yeah, we're just so aware of it. Yeah, but exactly. That's why we have lots of references when you think about. Okay, let's stop today. I don't know whether the hospital will let me out next weekend. We'll have to see.
You do push the envelope, don't you? I had to smile when I read that. I've got my plans, you medical people. So. Don't interfere with them.
No, well, they don't actually do anything at the weekends. They're not there Saturday or Sunday.
Get rid of you,
they just don't work Saturday or Sunday. So then it just has to sit there and lie there for the weekend. I have to ask permission if I can come out. And then somebody has to come pick me up and bring me back. And all of that goes with it.
Should be no problem.
So please, you know, do practice these simple things. Then you will learn from your own experience, and that's what it's about. Anything, you know, whether Sogyal Rinpoche has given you some practice to do, you need to do it. It's not going to help if you don't do it. You have to familiarize yourself over and over again until it becomes natural. Anything, any practice that you do. Otherwise, our perception doesn't change. Our habits stay intact. At the end of our meetings, then we dedicate the positive energy that we cultivate together. Can I have a sheet of paper? And we say some prayers for the long life of our teachers and the swift rebirth of our teacher Shagdar Rinpoche. And I really think he's back already, but anyway, we'll say the prayers, and we just got to find him. Maybe it should be a prayer to find him, other than swift rebirth. Everybody feels sure he's back already, just don't know where he is. Okay, so always it's nice to share the energy with others. Don't keep it for yourself. Always consider the confusion and suffering in the world, and how great it would be if we could remove or release each being's mind from this confusion and suffering. We look around us at all the conflicts in the world. My goodness, everywhere you look, you pick up a paper and there's very little positive news. My goodness, we really need to put some positive energy out there.
Throughout my many lives and until this moment, whatever virtue I have accomplished, including the marriage generated by this practice, is all I will ever attain. This I offer for the welfare of all sentient beings. For sickness, war, famine, and suffering be decreased for every being, for the wisdom and compassion and peace in this and every future life. And I clearly perceive all experiences to be as insubstantial as the dream fabric of the night, and instantly awaken to perceive pure wisdom displayed in the arising of every phenomenon. May I quickly attain enlightenment, or it will ceaselessly for the liberation of all sentient beings.
Okay, hold it there. Now, those last three lines. May I clearly perceive all experiences to be as insubstantial as the dream fabric of the night. You know, this is what we're talking about. Nothing else than what we're talking about here. And instantly awaken to perceive the pure wisdom display in the arising of every phenomena. The true aspect of every phenomena. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
Buddhism, Bodhisattvas all together, whatever kind of motivation you have, whatever kind of beneficial action, whatever kind of wishing prayers, whatever kind of omniscience, whatever kind of life accomplishment, whatever kind of benevolent power, and whatever kind of immense wisdom you have, and similarly I, who have come the same way to benefit beings, pray to attain these qualities. At this very moment, for the peoples and the nations of the earth, may your life in the names, disease, famine, war, and suffering be heard. Rather may your moral conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase,
Om Guru Dhamma Sihon.
next week, and I'm afraid I have no internet access in this hospital.